This episode of AetherStream is brought to you by Aetherflow Media. We would not be able to create content like this without the support of our amazing patrons.
Welcome back to AetherStream. I'm your host, Tilip, with Dylan and Croa.
Hello.
Hello.
So, Croa, when we left off, we were just coming back to the Crystarium with the first night in hundreds of years. Did you want to take off from there?
Yes. So we left off with the Light Wardens. We took out the first Light Warden and how the Crystal Exer had explained to us that this was the way to prevent the Aethemporal Calamity because of the unique physiology, aetherology, I should say, behind this creature. And everyone is astounded at the fact that this night has happened. They haven't seen it. There's a lot of people that have been born and raised without seeing a single night. So this is the first time they've seen night. This is the first time they've seen the stars. And, immediately the Crystal Exarch makes the motion to request that you don't say that it was you that did this. Mainly for two reasons. They explain that a lot of people would be extremely confused because they don't know, they've not experienced this yet, and they need a little bit of time to recuperate. And Alpha Note goes on to explain that Yulmor would be very unhappy that you've basically removed the source of power for their closest allies, which are the Sin Eaters. So,
if you think about it, we're already Yulmor's most wanted. That on top of it's just
they're a little mad. They're a little mad that we, basically backtalk the Lord, but now we've started to steal their power. So it's just, we're just getting more and more hot water with the Yulmorans. And, so you make this promise to not say anything. He requests Lena to make the same promise, and you start heading back. And, everyone's kind of departing. They're all saying, great job out there. You did a good job. And you have the opportunity to visit the Wandering Stairs, which is the area of the bar where if you had the opportunity to see, the bartender is actually the same guy that was in the trailer for 1.0. They use the same model, the Rogan in there that serves. Okay, wait, he's not a Rogan. He's a Galgiant. There you go. I got to remember that. And so he makes the proposal to you. He says, we have a lot of people here now, and most of them are bounty hunters. And he explains that there's a system, kind of like an economic system, that's been established by the Settlement Council, that there are sometimes, so Sin Eaters work like an ant colony. You have the Light Wardens, which are like the queen, and then all the lesser Sin Eaters, which surround the queen and do everything the queen bids. Now, every once in a while, there'll be a Sin Eater that will step away from this hive, so to say, and will wander on their own. And that's usually the source of most of the encounters on the road. So all the random freak encounters that people experience with Sin Eaters come from the fact that these Sin Eaters break off from the hive and they kind of just wander and eat ether on their own. And there's a group of these Sin Eaters known as the Cardinal Virtues. And these bounty hunters are after them. Now, you get the context of the Cardinal Virtues and who they are. And it turns out that the Cardinal Virtues are Sin Eaters that are created from the old Warriors of Light, or as the people know it, the villains that caused the Flood. And you now have the opportunity, you receive the opportunity after that is explained to you, to accept the role quests and pick each role quest based on what your job is to further explore the story behind the Cardinal Virtues and who they were in the past life. People that we met before, prior to them being turned into Sin Eaters. I don't know if you want to talk about those guys.
Well,
Cardinal Virtues.
I mean, I don't know, because like part of it to me feels like it's part of a spoiler territory when it comes to like, I know it's branching out, but
it's more like this. We know the Cardinal Virtues, they explain them to be the villains that caused Flood. And we know the villains that caused the Flood were the Warriors of Darkness who we met in 3.4. So each of them are one of those. And then basically, instead, role quest would be something we could get into further, but it would just be understanding that they were once people we fought as people, and they're now been turned into Sin Eaters. And now we get to find a little bit more of their backstory by taking the roles that they used to hold.
Yeah, and I think really quick, like you definitely get into more of the personal backstory of each one of the Warriors of Light, which I had the healer and then also DPS. And I have to say, out of those two, I really love the healer. I thought she was adorable. But as far as the whole story, it's something that, I mean, as far as talking about it, it can be talked about it as far as like in the episodes as you experience it throughout the MSQ. But one thing I kind of wish is that you could actually later, after you finished it, go back through all of it together, because seeing the whole story together is crazy. It's really impactful. So yeah, like I personally want to talk about those like really in depth at a later point, like all together.
Yeah, that's definitely a future episode to go over those. The opportunity arises, though, as a result. They basically explain that these bounty hunters are now jumping to action because they see night for the first time, and they hear stories of the Warrior of Darkness is here, and the Warrior of Darkness is here to save them. And that emotion, that energy that comes from that hope is pushing them forward to want to hunt down these cardinal virtues. So they've been hunting for a while now and have had no luck, and they're hoping to find a companion in order to help them gain, you know, sort of a headway towards hunting these creatures. Once you take the opportunity to check these out, you head down to the pendants, you get your rest. Now, we actually didn't have the opportunity last episode. We crossed over it. We had the time constraints and stuff. We missed it, but we didn't talk about Arbert.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Mr. Visitor in our, private chambers.
There's definitely a lot to say about Arbert. Yeah.
It was around this point you meet him. You run into him for the second time. You know, you have the opportunity to be like, "Hey, man, this is my private quarters. Can you not bother me?" And he even goes to say, he's like, "Oh, I know it's your private quarters. I'm trying to help you, because if you talk to me out in public, people are going to think you're crazy. You're the only one that can see me, so I'm trying to help you here." It's the only reason why he bothers you when you go to bed.
Yeah. And, still slightly holding a grudge towards Minfilia at this point, because he's like, I mean, you don't get the full story of why he's wandering, but you can tell he's holding a grudge towards the Child of Light.
Yeah, they expound on his, you know, reasoning for being there, and he's the same person that he was before, but, you know, it comes as a shock to you, because you last time you saw him was 3.4 when he teleports away, and now you're seeing him as a phantom. You know, and he asks you how long has it been, and you tell him 100 years, and he's like, "I've been wandering for 100 years. What?" Like, he's not even aware. He's like, he just remembers starting to wander and then everything kind of fading away, and then as soon as you entered the first, all his senses returned. He received that kind of awakening shock. They have a headcanon, because he actually was raised as a fisher. They say that when he mentioned that he was woke up like he was pulled out of the fish of the water, it was kind of referring to his lifestyle. You know, he was able to make that metaphor because he understood the concept of fishing, so he used that as a, you know, to explain how he just suddenly was aware of himself again. And then he walks, and he's walking, and he runs into you, and he's like, "I know you. We fought before." Wait a second. What are you doing here?
See, and that's really interesting for a couple of reasons. Like, first of all, like at the end of 3.4, I know at least for myself, and I imagine a lot of other people, just kind of the assumptions like, oh, okay, all of the Warriors of Darkness are going off with Moonfilia back to their home world. Everything's going to be okay now, because, I mean, obviously it must be, because we haven't had another calamity yet, right?
Yeah.
So when you get back there and you're talking to Ardbert, you really kind of get the sense of, okay, things didn't go horribly wrong, but they didn't really go all that right either.
Oh, it was, I wasn't ready for the sheer amount of just not so great resolution that came out of the Warriors of Darkness returning to their homeworld.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it ends, and you know, there's that phrasing that Ardbert drops right before he leaves. You know, he warns you, and he tells you, you know, don't be like us. You know, darkness, light, it doesn't really matter. What matters is how you use it. And those are his final words to you before he, you know, goes on to the next realm. And honestly, we have no indication whatsoever from 3.4 onwards. We had an entire expansion between that moment. Mm-hmm. We have no indication what's going on. And then we show up to his homeworld, and we learn that it didn't really work out so well. The Warriors of Darkness, all those people that you saw leave with hope in their hearts, became, you know, the cardinal virtues. And then Ardbert's been wandering for 1,000 years as a ghost. It's like, wait a second, hold up.
Yeah.
Ouch.
Like, yeah.
Like the only hints that we got were just like the weakening of the Aether, but we didn't realize that it was actually connected to the first until Boom.
Yes, yeah. That was a new concept they revealed to us. We understood that the worlds were once part of the source and were split from the source. They're copied from the source. We understood that. And they gave us that information 3.2, I believe, is when they first mentioned the concept of shards. But we didn't understand particularly that whatever was affecting the shard would affect the source. And part of the reason. Now, it's really interesting. And we're bringing that back up, the thinning of the ether. That happened before Dalamud. That happened before the Battle of Cartano, because in 1.0 you could actually find crystals like that. You could actually, and they explained it was a result of the calamity.
Interesting.
So they reused that source concept. They reused that ongoing effect to explain the oncoming of the Eighth Umbral Calamity, which was really, it was really nice continuity to see that they borrowed those elements from 1.0 to explain what was going on in 5.0.
Yeah. One thing though that you mentioned about Ardvert specifically that, you know, just really was interesting to me just now is that you mentioned that he had grown up as a fisherman. And, you know, granted, I'm referring to a movie here and I don't recall the actual mythology, but it makes me think of Perseus from like Clash of the Titans.
Yeah. Oh, like Percy Jackson. Perseus. No, sorry, wrong
Perseus.
Wrong movie.
But yeah, like how he had been a fisherman and then all of a sudden it was kind of thrust upon him to become this hero. And he is most notable in Greek mythology for being the one Greek hero who didn't meet a horribly painful end. Yeah, like, I mean, because all of the other, like, even, you know, Heracles, depending on which mythology you read, he essentially dies from being covered in Hydra blood and it, like, burns his skin off. So, yeah, the Greek do not fool around. But, you know, Perseus is a
hero.
Yeah, actually has a happy ending. Mm-hmm. So I find it interesting. Here you have this Perseus-like figure. And instead of getting the happy ending that, you know, hey, of course, in like every story. Yeah, he has a pretty bittersweet ending. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's really interesting as far as you kind of get into the depth of on the surface, a hero has this great and wonderful journey. He defeats evil. Everything's great. Hooray. But
it causes his world to fall apart. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. It goes really into the, you know, no pun intended, shades of gray, you know.
It's like, did he actually do a good thing? And the fact that everyone considers him a bad guy. Like, he's gone down in history as a villain. That's that they even, you know, when you go over jumping a little bit back, when they tell you to talk to the librarian and he tells a story, he's like, the villains who slayed the Shadow Keeper. He's talking about the people who were known as Warriors of Light in the past. And that's crazy. Like, they just shifted complete in their the way they were perceived by the society.
Well, and as a true form of like hell and punishment, not only did he fail to do what he set out to do, he has now been wandering for 100 years, getting to see how much the people resent him.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a special kind of hell.
Oh, it's terrible. Tore him up too. He said he even lost his mind. You know, he started to fray at the edges for a while. Was just wandering on the fringe of existence.
Yeah. And even as like, you know, he said in the trailer, it's like, you know, what was it all for?
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
So,
but like,
Like,
can you imagine just the mental state he went from for trying to help out, you know, not asking for anything in return, got chosen to be basically a warrior of light and then ended up being the villain because of the light. Mm-hmm. Like, can you imagine the mental state from being like, hey, I'm just going to help you out. Then they're like, oh, you're the chosen one. And it's like, and then, you know, you do that one last deed and then all of a sudden, that last deed is what started to cause this.
Yep.
Yeah. And, you know, you guys gave up your bodies just to travel to the source just to figure out a solution. And your solution was basically what turned you guys into a villain.
Mm-hmm.
Even though yet they still call the Child of Light technically a hero, even though she was there. Well, she saved everybody from the flood, but still.
There's a different, the Oracle of Light, they have. It actually comes next, so we'll save her for that.
Okay.
So one last thing from this result of the first night in 100 years, a lot of the NPCs, kind of the main NPCs that you talk to when you first started the Crystarium, changed their text. And so that's one thing I noticed in Shadowbringers, a lot of people changed their text. A lot of the NPCs had new things to say about what was going on. So it was always good to kind of like check back and talk to the people you talked before. And, the bartender, you know, was talking about how he was stunned more than surprised because he had never seen a knight before. And he said he couldn't even see it because of the tears in his eyes. He was crying the whole time while the knight was happening. And it's just, I mean, it really puts into perspective how important this symbol was for them to see the knight again, like to see darkness again. So, going on to the next, you know, the part is we ended up waking up to bad news. It's really funny because, you know, you literally wake up and you go outside and then the innkeeper's like, hey, so we got a problem, and explains that Yulmor has been sent to occupy Lakeland. And, you know, they saw the airship in the night and then they ended up taking over Laxan Loft, which is a big old castle keep in the middle of Lakeland. And so they explained that it has something to do with, you know, the generals there. So it's like really... not, you know, it's not good, you know. General Ranjit is his name, and this is the first time you meet him. And there's that part where, you know, the XR casts that spell over you where you were turned invisible, and General Ranjit walks in and he explains the terms. He's like, so you guys killed the Light Warden. That's not good. You're bad. we're going to have to figure out what we're going to do with you because of that action, because you're messing up with our allies. And there's that one scene where General Ranjit walks away and then he stares straight at you while you're invisible. And that gave me some chills.
Well, I think the thing about that was the Exarch may have cast a way to make you disappear, but you can still smell, you can still make sound. I don't know about the sound part, but, you know, it, as far as I'm aware of, it was like an invisibility.
Yeah.
So if he could, since he is a general, he probably has one of those, basically where he can sense presence of a worthy foe.
Mm-hmm.
Like he can acknowledge it without even seeing them.
Yeah. He stares at you and he's like, I'm not going to bother with that. Like, it's just that show of power, the casual, I'm better than you, but you don't know it yet.
It's like, so you are hiding there.
And then we'll shrugs and walks away. Yep. Yeah. That was,
we'll
that
meet
was
again.
Big power move there.
I kind of get the feeling that there's something a little bit more to Ranjit than what we know.
We actually might be able to, I don't know if it's jumping ahead, but it's kind of, since it is our first time meeting this character, they actually explained in Gamescom, so this was translated from the lore panel, but with Oda-san and Yoshida, that General Ranjit belongs to a nation that was destroyed in the flood. That's why that's why his naming conventions don't fit any of the other characters or the other species there. That's why he has that fighting style with, it's like kind of like his a really specific magical martial arts, monkish kind of thing that he's got going on with the dragon. All of that comes from a complete society and nation and clan that was destroyed in the flood. He's the only survivor. So he's the only one that kept that tradition going. So that's why he's very unique as far as, you know, being a member of the Yulmoran society and such, because he didn't really fit there at all. He was a refugee at best that managed to make it to Yulmor during the flood and kept his tradition alive in that area.
So do you get the feeling that his nation or clan is probably more parallel to Alamigo or to Garlemald?
Oh, I don't, with the monk tradition, I'm leaning towards Alamigo, or at least an Alamigo analog. I know they already had some sort of Far East analog, due to the, so this is kind of like off information, the Black Hayate, which is the dog minion. If you read its flavor text, it explains that it was named after a weapon from a nation that no longer exists because the flood destroyed it. So, and the Hayate is it's a Japanese word, so there's some sort of Far East analog as well. So for the most part, the continents are intact and cultures that are similar to the ones on the source. Not all of them survived, but there were some, and a lot of them, as the flood was taking place, they took their pilgrimages and they got as far as away from the flood as they could before it stopped. And so we get those like survivors, remnants of those cultures along with Novarant and what was managed to stay around after the flood had ceased. So it's really interesting.
Yeah. Well, and I'm just thinking back and I just thinking about like the Humes or here, however you want to look at it. Mm-hmm. I don't think I recall all that many Highlander models. I think the majority of them, I think they were Midlander. I'm sure there was some Highlanders out there, but the majority of them, I think, were Midlander. The only other Highlander model I could think of was back in Yule Moor when you did that one quest where you had to go find the attendant.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he was definitely Highlander. I even remember thinking at the time, it's like, oh, huh, I don't see a lot of those guys around.
Yeah, and that's really interesting. I know for a fact the Highlander clan didn't really start to come into existence until after the Sixth Umbral Calamity. And that was a result of all the survivors of Amdapur and Mach running into the mountains. The society that they established in the mountains after all that clan infighting is what became the Highlanders. And it just kind of grew out from that. From that war, from Anselm Cotter, first king of Alamigo.
Yeah.
And his clan and his people were the ancestors of the Highlanders. So, you know, there's a lot of history behind the Highlander existence. And without that peace, without the mountains per se, because they definitely say that the bulk of their muscle comes from high altitudes, you know, living in that environment for so long.
Where you have to walk 15 miles.
Yeah. Well, and that's one thing I have to give the writers a lot of credit for, especially throughout the MSQ, is there's a lot, they're really very cognizant of continuity. Mm-hmm. For example, just like even cultural, as far as like the Elizan or elves in the first, and the fact that there's definitely some cultural differences with them, as a fact that they didn't go through the whole Dragon Song War. They don't have the thing in their history where their ancestors ate dragon eyes and have that taint. And you know, as a result, they don't have also that strong connection to religion. So it was interesting as far as how that kind of changed elves on the first as a culture as compared to on the source.
Yeah, and the same, you know, they have the elves and then, you know, the dwarves, which is like completely far removed from Lalafell culture.
Oh, God, yeah.
And also, I think the one thing that kind of gave everybody a little bit of pause is the Amalja and the fact that they're really integrated into society. I remember just sitting there thinking like, wow, this really makes me feel even worse about how much.
And it's more like, I think the big thing to pull from that is to see how, so the major difference between source society and first society is the fact, okay, so it's kind of like a pull from 1.0, but the fact that when the Garleans were attacked, right, the Garlean empire's push into Eorzea, that was what pushed the beast tribes into summoning the primals, and the primals tempered them and made them into the violent, aggressive society, you know, enemies that we deal with on a constant basis in Eorzea. But because there is no empire or imperial influence on the first, there's no threat of war from a larger entity, there are no primals. There's no one summoning because there's no one in fear or in that sense of that state, you know, that they feel that they have to constantly summon. And it's like, I guess you can describe it as one of many cards that the Ascians have to play. They knew that by the Empire pushing forward, the best card they could play was causing people to turn to their gods for help. They did that before with the Alagan Empire. You know, they pushed Alagans into attacking Miracidia. And when Miracidia was at the brink of destruction, the Ascians got them to summon primals. So it's one of those, if it works, don't change it kind of thing. You know, the Ascians like to use what's effective in their plans. And so they tried that with Eorzea. And that's why we have all these beast tribes who they, you know, it's really funny. There's an article in the lore book that it's like an apologist article for the beast tribes trying to say, why are we calling them beast tribes? They're not even beasts. They have culture too. Mm-hmm. And it's a really interesting article because it takes into perspective. You learn pretty quickly that the term beast tribe is a political move that was made by Uldah, and it was a term that was borrowed from the Garleans. And it was an attempt to get Uldah was trying to cater to Garlean's good side. And it was a business deal. The syndicate wanted to continue to make business with the Garleans. And so they're sitting there, all right, bye, base tribes. Garleans hate you. We're not going to pretend to hate you too. And that's why the only tribes that are permitted within any, you know, distance are like really, really important businessmen and women. But there's no significant element of beast tribe influence. And furthermore, with the Garleans attacking, they're all worshiping and summoning the primals, who then warp their minds. So for the most part, the large portion of beast tribes are taken over by primals. And it's just this really crazy, like, messed up, man, I wish really people would stop being bad and try to make amends, you know? Because the Malja think all of Thanlan is sacred land. They believe that Thanlan was blessed by Ifrit, and they deserve the lands of Uldah, and they can't really get into it because, you know, Uldah is there and Uldah prevents them. So it's just like Holy Land kind of crusade style thing that's going on.
Mm-hmm.
But then on the first, they take care of the Amaro and their arts of husbandry have kept the species of Amaro thriving for centuries. You know, they even say that we do it better than everyone else. That's why we're here. And it's really cool to see that. The massive difference. I mean, it's like, it's not tiny. It's a huge change of culture and history. And it makes you wonder if the Uldahns tried to parlay with the Malja, would something similar take place on the source?
Kind of makes me wonder if I play through the game again and kind of keep an eye, because I know in some of the city states you can see some of the beast tribes or beastmen there, but I don't know if they're there in the very beginning.
It's mostly goblins, the Mamelja, and the Kikern are the ones that are allowed to do business. The others are banned.
Oh, okay.
So one thing that's actually really interesting in all of this context, if you think about it, is the fact that the Garlean Empire was founded by Emmett Selk. Mm-hmm. And the Garlean Empire, one of the things that is most notable is that they are an atheistic society. They don't believe in any god. Mm-hmm. So with what you were saying, as far as Asians using the card of having all of these tribes or people call upon their gods, and here you have an Asian who founded a society that does not believe in gods.
He's godless, yeah.
Yeah, very, very godless. And so it's kind of interesting as far as why they would choose to do that. It's but more like,
if I understand it, the Asians have a shared goal, but in order to reach that goal, they tend not to like work together, if that makes sense. They all know that they want to achieve the same goal, which is bringing Zodiac back, but they don't do any sort of like collaborations. You know, they're all on their own page of music, and as long as it kind of goes parallel to each other, as long as the tune kind of fits, they're cool with it. But there's a lot of disagreements. You know, 1.0 is in Realm Reborn, you know, Elidibus runs into that Nabrialis, and they kind of get in a fight. Not in like a fist fight, but like, he's like, what are you doing here? You're an emissary. Go away. Mm-hmm. You know? And then Nabrialis is like, we got this. And Elidibus is like, but I'm curious. I want to do some things. And Nabrialis is like, well, I'm not, so get out of my way. And it's like, you can tell that there's this weird, like, they're not really teammates so much as they're more like, you know, business. I guess they're like a corporation, you know, each of them is a manager of their own kind of property, and they work towards each other, but they're still competing. So it's like, it's really interesting. They have that dynamic. That's not everyone's on the same page. Like, they make mistakes just as much as anyone else.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. One last thing before we continue on with back to the main story.
Yeah.
How many, without doing too much spoilers, but how many of the assassins are left? Because I know we had that one cutscene in 2.something where we had like a whole room filled with at least a dozen, maybe. Yeah.
So there should be, as far as we understand it, there's 13. There's 13. We know that La Habrea, and you know, he's as far as we understand, there's a lot of debate about it, but I'm just going to go with the party that I think he's gone for now until they decide otherwise.
Right.
Because, you know, at any point in time, he could just suddenly be back. But as far as we know, La Habrea was gone at the end of 3.0. Igeorum was gone at the end of 3.0. We know that there's a mention, you know, Nabrialis got taken out in the Realm Reborn's, I think it was 2.4, 2.3, 2.4, somewhere around the end.
Yeah.
It was when Mobrita passed away. It was that event that took Nabriela's. So that's 3 out of 13. We're down to 10. Now, there's a lot of... What's really great about Shadowbringers is that later on, as we continue to get into it, we're going to be able to learn a lot more about Ascian lore. So it's really... I'm trying to save that information for later.
Okay. No worries.
So, but to help explain, you know, yeah. But yeah, that's where we're at right now.
Okay.
But going back to the main scenario, and we have Yulmor occupying Crystarian territory. Ranjit makes his points. He's like, well, if you don't stop, we're going to have problems, and walks away while threatening you silently, staring directly at you. And, you know, you overheard Minfilia, the phrase Minfilia. And so Exarch explains to you, you know, yes, you did hear the right name, but it's not who you think it is. I could explain it, but I think it'd be better if you read the story. And so you end up going to the library. They explain to you who Minfilia is. And it's the name of the person known as the Oracle of Light. And so the original story is that Minfilia halted the flood a century ago and, you know, she disappeared. At that point, all they saw was this woman standing and holding the flood at bay and turning into solid crystal. The results of that you can see in Amarang. And from that point on, young maidens, that literally look like her, described with, you know, the flaxen hair and the sapphire eyes, would be born, and they were immune to the Sin Eaters. And because they bore the same name, Minfilia, as they identified themselves as Minfilia. The first one was brought into the Yulmoran army and trained with them and fought alongside them to kill Sin Eaters. But what happens is that the Minfilia would get killed, and once a Minfilia was killed, there another would be born. And so this apparently went on for a while. Until for generations, you know, a couple, probably two or three versions of Minfilia before the last Minfilia, you know, was not permitted to fight. And the Yulmorans decided to join with the Sin Eaters rather than fight them. And so she was rescued by an unnamed hero. That's all they say. And is now back under their custody and is currently at Laxan Loft. So, you know, you end up realizing, oh, hey, the unnamed hero was probably Thancred. We haven't seen him in a while. So let's go ahead and try to help them out and rescue Minfilia from the Yulmorans. You know, you get to visit all these people in the Crystarium. They help you prepare for war. You know, you get
I like
to
how we're given garments just to actually attend this fight too.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep. You know, you fly out to the Austell Imperative. You get, you know, Lena's like, you know, you may be the Warrior of Darkness, but now you're under my army. So, and our army wears outfits. And so she tells you what to do so you can get the outfit. And this is where you get to do that solo duty, you know, in the quest Oracle of Light. So you are given, you know, the serum. You take the serum, and then the plan is that they're going to take this powder and drop it all over the Yulmoran army, make them all pass out. And, you know, prevent as many casualties as possible in the process of rescuing Minfilia. And, you know, you help the Amaro take this as serum because they don't want to take it directly. You have to put in their food and got a little bit of fetch quests here and there. But then you get ready to fight. And so it's really funny because you're doing really good. Like when the solo quest starts, everyone's asleep already. You know, the Amaro have flown over and dropped the powder on everyone. And so there's some fighting going on, but it's not as bad as it would have been. Because it's the reminder is that the Yulmoran army is the strongest military presence in Novarant right now. So that's why they kind of wanted to do the whole, let's equalize the tables with this powder, with this alchemy. And right before you get to Minfilia, Ranjit shows up and he just beats everyone. And he beats you too. Like he took a lot of hits, and it was funny because, you know, he's like, this isn't hard at all. But then when he gets you, he's like, why are you stronger than the rest of them? What's going on with this? Are you some secret trump card? You know, he starts making his, like, he starts noticing something's different about you.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. But, I definitely started getting like Xena's flashbacks there.
Oh yeah. It was just like that because he was over, you know, he was stronger. So they made you fight for that win, but he was still like, okay, why are you harder to beat than the others? You know, why are the others on the floor, but you're like still standing.
Yeah.
And, you know, you keep trying to fight, and then Thancred shows up, coolest scene ever, with his gun blade and twisting and turning, you know, fighting Ranjit as well. And it creates, you know, he tells you, get out of here. You know, you need to run. And as you're running, you end up heading in the direction of Ilmeg. And Ranjit does this super hardcore Dragon Ball move. Like, he's getting ready. He's like, you know,
he lowers himself
and he's ready to launch. But then the Exarch stops him with a stone spell. And it was just because he used Break, which is a, you know, typical Final Fantasy petrification spell. Yeah. And it was just really cool to see that kind of like reference to Final Fantasy. You know, you're still in that world. And it stops him long enough just for you to be able to head into the direction of the Fairy Kingdom. And I think that would be a good place to stop.
So two things before we end today. First of all, with all due respect to the other Scions, Thancred, best entrance ever.
Oh, yes, yeah. That was by far. That was a good opening. That was a, hey, I'm back, guys.
Yeah. So that was kind of one thing. And the other thing is that, especially with Rinji, like you mentioned the whole Dragon Ball Z thing, which was pretty funny.
He was ready to go.
Oh, yeah. He really was. And the thing is I really already love him as a villain. And if he's gone, I'm going to be very sad. But the third and final thing is, especially at this point in the MSQ, like I remember looking at the Exarch and just thinking, like, just as a whole, as a character, he seemed really emblematic of Final Fantasy as a franchise and what he's all about. Like you said, you know, he used the Break spell, but also the kind of the mystery, and he's almost this kind of, you know, prophet guy. And also it was at this point that I kind of started thinking, like, I don't know if I trust him.
Yep.
Like, I think he's got something up his sleeve. I mean, this guy is super powerful, but yet, but yeah, no, just a really great character.
Oh yeah, they did a really good job of them.
Mm-hmm. So any other final comments as far as the story thus far?
One thing, so this is actually, for me personally, during the whole solo duty where, you know, you went out of your way to acquire this alchemical powder to put the Yulmorans to sleep. I found it. So this is actually one. I had this weird feeling. I'm gonna try to describe it. It was like a very defined uniqueness of the scenario that belonged to the first. Because, you know, for the longest time, you know, we've been playing on the source and we've been doing things, you know, in a particular pattern. You know, going into a war, stopping the war, you know, becoming the heroes, and then bringing the nation back into the fold. You know, we saved three nations at this point before we end up going to the first. But for some reason, as this conflict unfolds there, and I'll bring it up as we go through the episodes, I'll bring it up. I get this feeling where it's like, I don't think we would do something like this on the source, using powder to put the Yulmorans asleep. There's another very distinct event that made me feel that same way. And I like that. I liked that they were able to write a story that still was built within the mechanics and the setting of Final Fantasy XIV, but still retained a uniqueness all on its own that allowed the world itself to exist in a separate sphere from everything else that's already been presented. And for me, that was that event when we're dropping powder on soldiers. I was like, yeah. That's very, huh? That's new.
It's really kind of emblematic of those, like, as far as the Journey of the Warrior of Light, and I mean the story itself, and the fact that, like you said, is here's this instance where we're definitely on our back foot. We're not the most powerful guy.
We have to think smarter.
And instead of just like, you know, before we were like, hey, I'm the Warrior of Light and I'm here.
Run through this
big
Garlean army with myself.
Kind of like Gimlet Dark.
Oh god.
But yeah, that's my final words on it. Definitely good stuff so far.
Oh yeah. What about you, Telp? Any final thoughts?
No, actually there's I still have my doubts on like which teams that we're supposed to be trusting, which ones are in the right, which ones are in the wrong. Like the fact that Thancred didn't even come running, I don't know if it's because at that time I didn't know if his Aether was still corrupted or not. But I felt like something was missing, like as if we couldn't even trust our own teammates. And I do like that because, you know, they've been, especially Thancred, he's been there for 5 years compared to the others. So he's got the most experience in a foreign land as opposed to us who just happened to walk right through the gates. But other than that, I'm loving Ranjit the way he was. just kind of gave me more of that Shaolin master, not like all powerful, but can definitely counter anything you throw at him.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
So,
but the
mystical powers of the Exarch, I don't know. It just seemed like something was off. Like as Dylan was pointing out, don't know if we could trust him or not. Sorry, my puppy wants to talk in. But other than that, I do wish that we could have gotten the Exarch to shed a little bit more light instead of just being like, oh, just go with the army, prepare yourselves, take this stuff, and then, you know, follow along our side, as opposed to just, you know what I'm saying, why we're fighting with them, as opposed to, because we already went to a dungeon just off of his thesis.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Trust me, I'm the Exarch.
Yeah, exactly. So other than that, I really don't have much else to add to it at this time. I also have a cranky dog, too, now. So.
Well, that seems like it's it then for this week.
Yep. Hopefully next time we can actually dive into our new found territory of Ilmeg.
And how pixies are dicks.
And the reason why they didn't quite pursue us right away. Because if you notice, they hesitated before they went and chased us.
Yeah. Please look forward to us butchering all the pixie names, because those are hard to pronounce.
But thank you guys for tuning in. I greatly appreciate it.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully always next time. Yep. Always a pleasure. And hopefully next time we can get some more fairy action and meet some more of our comrades.
Mm-hmm.
Until then, guys, later days.
Bye.
Bye.
AetherStream is part of Aetherflow Media, a community-based project with a focus on Final Fantasy XIV. Aside from this podcast, we produce web content and our magazine, Aetherflow. And if you like what you see and hear, consider joining our Patreon, which you can find at patreon.com/aetherflowmedia. All funds go towards providing you with the best possible content that we can create.